Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. The show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, July 23rd, 2017. This is episode 1407. Enjoy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk about computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography and smartphones and smart watches and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number, 888-827-5536 if you have a question, a comment, a suggestion. Used to say back in the old days, in the mid-90s, if you'd like a little hand-holding on the information superhighway. It's kind of a funny now, if you think back on it, we called the internet the information superhighway. I think that was because you couldn't explain what the internet was to people. You really couldn't. And so one thing they likened it to was the interstate freeway system, which was created by Al Gore's father in the 50s when he was a member of Congress. Not fully by him, obviously. Some other people had a hand in it, but Al Gore's father was a champion of it. And that's why in a few decades later, people often credited Al Gore with inventing the internet. I think he might have taken a little bit of credit. But in some similar ways, he facilitated the funding for the information superhighway. See, the highway system that connects us and our data. It is like a freeway system. I guess it's kind of like that. And actually, that might be a useful analogy when you're trying to understand this debate over net neutrality. You know, we were talking about that last week. The idea that bits should flow along the information superhighway without being impeded in any way artificially by, let's say, an internet service provider. If the internet is an information superhighway, then the internet service provider is kind of the exit ramp. How you get how that stuff going back and forth across the country gets to your home, it takes the exit for your town, USA. And then via the internet service provider comes to your house. But what if there were – wouldn't that be annoying if there were toll roads across town? Like you'd get off the freeway and then you'd have to pay a toll to get to your house. Especially – it would be especially annoying if the people who were asking for the toll, you were already paying anyway. And then when trucks wanted to come deliver goods to you from Amazon, they would stop them and say – look, you can't deliver the goods to Leo, but unless you pay this toll. That's kind of the idea of why we don't like net neutrality. This notion that internet service providers, who are already getting paid by you, would then ask for more money for Netflix or YouTube or me, because I do podcasting, to get to you. And the problem really is, and I just read a good article in Business Insider. It was actually a fellow named Bakshar Chakravorty who did some research and produced a report called Digital Planet 2017, How Competitiveness and Trust in Digital Economies Vary Across the World. His conclusion in this study is that we are stalling out here in the U.S. We've certainly been a leader in innovation, and the internet was created here. We built the first information superhighway, connected it to the rest of the world. We are the 10th most digitally advanced country today. Even that might frustrate some. 10th? What? We're number one. The problem is that investment in startups in the U.S. is slowing. That we are getting the worst among the worst internet in the world. The internet connectivity is controlled basically in the U.S. by five companies: Comcast, the number one internet service provider; Spectrum, formerly Time Warner; Verizon; CenturyLink; and AT&T. all but, you know, 80% of you, all but about one-fifth of you are using one of those five companies to get online. That's a lot of power concentrated in those five companies. And what those companies give us is both slower and more expensive than in many countries around the world. And they want more. And they want more control. They essentially are asking for the right to decide which companies can get to you, which innovations can reach the public, what it costs, and how fast. And that is contrary to productivity and innovation in this country. It keeps us, it will slow us down. So if you need an argument for why we should not reverse the rules on net neutrality, why we bits should be protected across as they travel across the internet, that's a good one. That's a really important one. It's where innovation happens. And we have really benefited, I think, don't you think, from the innovation that the internet and technology have brought us over the last 30 years. I've been, you know, I had ringside seats covering this amazing revolution back to when we called it the information superhighway and even before then. And I'd like to see the growth continue. Singapore plans to, Singapore, little tiny island nation Singapore, plans to invest $13 billion more in high-tech industries than we do in 2020. New Zealand, little tiny island nation New Zealand, is investing in a superior telecommunications system and creating incentives for entrepreneurs. The United Arab Emirates, it isn't an island, but it's small. They've created free trade zones, and they're turning Dubai into a smart city. You probably heard about the Dubai robotic police force. They want to create autonomous vehicle areas. They're interconnecting transportation, utilities, and government services. And that's great for them. That's great. But we ought to be doing the same thing. We ought to be investing in that, I think. And, of course, then there's China. China and India. India is already the world's second largest smartphone market after China. And it's about to explode because currently in India, only about a fifth of its people, there's 1.3 billion people in India, have access to the internet. That means there'll be a billion more people coming online, some say, as soon as 10 years from now. And they'll be from India. It's an opportunity for us. It's an opportunity for our companies as long as we stay competitive. Anyway, I don't want to preach to you. I thought I'd bring that up because I think the words net neutrality kind of are meaningless. It's hard to explain it to people. But maybe with that information superhighway analogy will help. How about Twitter? Do you use Twitter? I don't think very many people use Twitter, but Twitter's in the news all the time because, our administration uses Twitter. The president uses Twitter. Anthony Scaramucci, the new communications director, uses Twitter and apparently plans to continue to use Twitter as part of White House communications protocol. He's a fan. But Scaramucci's been doing an interesting thing. He's been going back and deleting his tweets from the last few years because they, were critical of Donald Trump and quite liberal. Whoops. But can you really delete your tweets? Apparently not, because, in fact, in a way, it attracted attention to those tweets, and many newspapers are now publishing them again. See, it's just something important to remember. For all of us, even if you don't use Twitter, when you put something online, it has a life of its own. And you might change your mind, you might change your position, you might change your job, but that stuff still exists. And it's certainly the case of a public figure. There's no deleting tweets. So whether you post it on Facebook or putting pictures up on Instagram or posting what you had, pictures of your sandwiches on Twitter, just remember that stuff's permanent, part of your permanent record. The president has from time to time deleted tweets too. And actually, that's a larger question. He's being sued right now because he's president. Of course, you can delete tweets. You're a private citizen. Because he's president, everything he does, including emails and tweets, yes, are part of the public record and owned by the people, believe it or not. So when he deletes tweets, he's actually violating the Records Act. But good news, you can't delete tweets. They live on. Just remember that next time you tweet. 8888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's take your calls next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Look who's here. The Phone Ranger, Heather Hammond. Hello, Heather.
Surprise.
Surprise, surprise, surprise. Welcome.
Thanks.
Heather is answering the phones, and there's a lot of calls. Is there a crisis in tech land? Is that why?
You think?
Here I am to save the day.
The tech guys on the way.
Come as you are. Dave Grohl says, yes, just the way you are. Don't go changing. Oh, that's another guy. Who should I talk to first here?
The same idea, though.
Yeah.
Sue in Visalia. I think I just heard you talking about this on your way in.
Oh. Well, let's see. Hello, Sue. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thank you, Heather. What can I do for you?
Yeah. I called in a couple weeks ago, but that is irrelevant. I just thought I'd tell you that.
Thank you. Anyway, wonderful to see you again. I missed you.
I know. I missed you, too. Well, actually, I didn't. I've been listening to you regularly.
But we got to put a mic in your house. Maybe you can get one of them Amazon Echo things, and then I can listen to you.
We just bought an Echo.
Oh, how do you like it?
Well, I gave it to my husband to set up. I thought it would raise his self-esteem.
Because they're finally a woman who listens to him, right? Yeah.
No, I mean, I was trying, and I desperately hoped he would be successful.
That's so funny.
He was utterly unsuccessful.
He's not a computer geek. Oh, it walks you through it, though. Doesn't she tell you, okay, now connect me and na 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 na.
No, listen, Leo, the only thing he knows how to do is watch YouTube videos to operate his Big Green Egg.
Oh, I'm a fan of the Big Green Egg, too. In fact, I'll be doing some smoking tomorrow on my day off.
Well, he's definitely a fan, and so he watches everyone. But
we'll do more Big Green Egg stuff on the show, I think. For those who don't know, it's a big grill thing, big green grill thing. It's wonderful. I love my Big Green Egg.
It's actually fabulous.
Yeah.
But anyway,
that's man's job. Fire. Good. Burn meat.
And usually it's the man's job to know tech. So my sister-in-law came to visit at one point. She said, "Oh, Butch, how do you da 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 da?" Butch looks blank and then looks at me, and I said, "Well, actually,
Sue is the geek in this household. Here.
I'm the geek. I'm the geek. Yep. And in fact, actually, that has to do with the website. The domain I registered, which is geeky old broad.
Oh, I love it.
Okay, but here's the thing: I have so many irons in the fire. I could, if given enough time, do a WordPress site. Although, I'm not going to sit for 5 hours on Lynda and learn how to do that. So I'm really saying to you, you have Website City. So if you were starting a website today and you didn't want to do the actual setup, but you're certainly
website
willing to
Website City, yes. So what do you want? First, let's see what you want to do with your website.
I want to have a continuing blog.
Good.
And actually, I love the name.
I mean, geekyoldbroad.com. Who wouldn't want to visit that?
Exactly. And believe me, these old people that I am in Rotary with, they need me.
These people have no clue. No, and it's wonderful. I mean, I think if you can help people, old or young, understand technology, it opens a whole world to them, particularly the internet, right?
Well, exactly. And I won't even go into it because it blew my mind. You, 3 weeks ago, I heard, and you were saying very casually, Google Photos will gather all your photos from all your sources. And I'm going, really? What? Do I have it on my phone? Yeah, I have it on both Pixel phones. Good. Is it on my computer? Well, yeah. Is it on my laptop? Uh-huh. I just today discovered... Oh, my gosh, Google Photos. But that's a whole other thing. I mean,
Sue, you're adorable. I think Butch is a lucky, lucky man. That's all I can say. He brings you burnt meat, and you bring him wisdom and laughter. So let's get your wisdom and laughter out to the world.
Let's get to the website.
Yeah, well, this is how you're going to do it, because the beauty of the web now is that anybody can publish on the web, and if you write something people are interested in, you can gain a great audience. It's been a great boon to so many people. To get a voice, right? So you've got the domain name, and I notice it's on Bluehost, so they do hosting.
Yeah.
But once you own a domain name, you can have it connected to any anywhere you want, right? So,
oh yeah,
WordPress.com, which I've mentioned, they're a sponsor, is an easy to use site where for a couple of bucks a month, without knowing anything about the web, you can set up a site. They start with all of these, and a lot of them. There's Squarespace.com, a former sponsor, and they also do a very similar idea where you go in there, you don't have to know anything about the web. You just pick a template, which is just something that you like the way it looks. And they have some designs specifically for blogs. They also have, you know, all these companies will have sites for selling stuff online, for bands, for, you know, for a variety of different uses. But yours is a simple blog. You might want to put pictures up there and so forth. Either Squarespace or WordPress would do very well. They're very simple. WordPress has a free tier, but then they put ads on it. So you might pay a couple of bucks a month to get the ads off. Those are probably the easiest way to do it. There are other companies. GoDaddy's one that has a kind of a site builder. Yeah. These are more old-fashioned tools. I don't like them as much. They produce kind of generic sites. The other one that you might look at that's also free is from Google itself. And if one of the things you want to do is incorporate your Google Photos into your blog, my wife uses a Google blog for her photos because it's so easy to do that. And they call their platform Blogger. And they bought that company from the guy who created Twitter, actually. Ev Williams created Blogger first before Twitter. And if you go to Blogspot or just search for Blogger, you'll find it. It's free. But you have to have Google Ads on it. I think you can then get the ads off somehow, maybe paying a couple of bucks. That's a little simpler. I don't think the designs are as slick, but they might be easier for you to understand and use. And really, the design is not what's important. I have a friend named Om Malik, who was very well-known in the tech circles. He created a very, very well-known tech journalism blog called GigaOm that for a long time chronicled what was going on. And Om has retired, basically. He's a venture capitalist now. And he's created his own blog at om.co, and it is the simplest thing in the world. It turns out, isn't this often the case, Sue, as you get older and more sophisticated, things get simpler in some ways. You know, it's less Baroque, less frills. You know, a great steak might be preferable to duck à l'orange, that kind of thing. So look at Ohms is a good example. I think he's on WordPress, but I'm not sure. But it is a good example of just a list of store articles. That's really all you need.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that if I had my druthers, in a perfect world, what I would do is go to one of the sites, and there are a bunch of them, where you can just hire one to do the initial setup. I can absolutely do the follow-up.
Well, I mentioned will have people who will do that for you.
Okay.
And you pay them.
They will be on the website, and they will have...
Yeah, both Squarespace and WordPress have lots of consultants who do a very good job. My wife's website, for her business, she used Squarespace, and a consultant there, I think she pays them $100 a month or something, and it just looks great. So absolutely you can do that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, coming up in an hour. Got some picture-taking advice. I think it's a really interesting hobby that I think a lot of people have taken up of late because we all, or many of us, almost all of us, have a pretty good camera in our pocket with our smartphone. And it's just kind of a natural thing to kind of go to the next level, start taking more pictures. Things like Google Photos, like Sue was talking about earlier, you organize them, share them. I think we've all kind of become photographers, haven't we? It's a great hobby that's really been transformed by technology. More pictures. What is that? I think the stat was more pictures were taken last year than in all of history before that. That's how it's exploded. Trillions of pictures a year. Michelle on the line from Northridge, California. Hi, Michelle. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you.
Okay, my question is, what's the difference between the old hard drive style and the new SSD for Mac, and which do you prefer?
Well, there's a big difference. In fact, I pulled off of my shelf a old hard drive. This is a really old hard drive, but all spinning hard drives are kind of basically the same. Randy Bilder made a clock out of mine, which is kind of funny. But they're kind of like record players, except instead of vinyl, the old hard drives have spinning metal plates. Sometimes they're glass. And they're magnetic, so they can be magnetized. And then the old hard drives had what we call read heads, one per platter. And hard drives today might have multiple platters, one per platter. Those read heads are just like the needle on a record player, except instead of reading the grooves, they're reading the magnetic signals coming off the spinning platter. So it's kind of like a record player meets cassette recorder. And of course, because it's a computer, everything's recorded as ones or zeros. That's just the way computers work, on or off. And so it's very easy in a magnetic material to have a charge or no charge. And actually, it's a little different than that, but that's roughly how it would work. So the platters spin very fast. On spinning hard drives, the slowest ones are 5,400 revolutions a minute. The fastest ones, 10,000, almost twice as fast revolutions a minute. And those little heads, the needle on the record player, move very quickly. They have a motor called an actuator. You can even hear it if you have an old-fashioned hard drive spinning. And as the spinning is going on, the spinning is, and you can hear the heads going as the actuator motor moves the heads around. The problem with that setup, besides the fact that there's a lot of moving parts that could easily be damaged if you drop a hard drive, or damaged in other ways by magnetic materials and so forth. The other problem with it is physics. The spinning and the moving of the heads take time. For instance, if you think about it, as the hard drive's spinning, even at 10,000 revolutions per minute, the head goes in, reads some sector, and then it has to wait for the hard drive to come all the way around to read the next one, and the next one, and the next one. So they call that seek time. That's how long it takes the head to move to the place you need. And okay. And that can be a significant amount of time. I mean, not in human terms, but for a computer, it could be milliseconds. So solid-state drives work a little differently. Instead of having any physically moving parts, they have little cells that can be electrically charged. It's almost identical to the stuff you put in your camera, you know, the memory card you put in your camera or an SD card. That's basically what a solid-state drive is. And it has some real advantages. Nothing's spinning, nothing's moving, so they're more reliable. You can drop one, there's nothing going to break, unless you really drop it and break the physical material. But also, there's no seek time, because it seeks at the speed of light. It can find data anywhere inside that solid-state drive just by jumping to it. So it really reduces the amount of time to get the data. Considerably, so much so that solid-state drives read data 10 or 20, even more, 100 times faster than a spinning drive. They write data a little bit more slowly because writing data involves charging those cells, and that takes a little bit of time. But it's still, overall, significantly faster and more reliable than a spinning hard drive. So I think that you does that answer your question? That's kind of the long answer. Yeah.
I wanted a long answer. I was trying to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And that answered my question, yes.
So having a – nowadays, I think most computers come with solid-state drives. Having a solid-state drive really does make a big difference. The overall speed of your computer is measured really in many different ways. So a lot of times we talk about, well, I have a 4 gigahertz processor. Well, that's just one part of it. A really fast processor, the brain of the computer, often spending time waiting – for the hard drive or even RAM memory, the place where stuff is stored on its way to the processor. It's certainly waiting for you. If you're using a computer to type, the amount of time between one key and the other, even if you're a 90-word-per-minute typist or 100-word or 200, if you were a 200-word-a-minute typist, would be an eon for a computer. A computer's just going, come on, next key, next, I'm waiting. I'm sitting here, I'm waiting. All right, next question.
Okay. I've been doing what you said and trying to back up my photos.
Good.
Three different places. And so...
Nice. Thank you, yeah, Michelle. Good.
I was doing it to the USB thumb drive. And now I was looking at the new Macs, and they have a new, is it called Thunderbolt?
Yeah. Thunderbolt. Yeah.
So... if I got a new computer in a few years, the drives I'm putting my pictures on...
You're going to be fine, because those new Thunderbolt ports, that they call them Type-C ports, you just take an adapter and you put it on that old USB key. So it's not a problem. I do it all the time now because I have lots of machines with these little thin Thunderbolt 3 ports. They don't look the same, and you wouldn't want to try to shove a thumb drive into one of those ports. But there's but it's easy for a buck. You can get an adapter that will just take the old thumb drive. Now, I do caution you. Thumb drives are notoriously unreliable, okay? They die over time. Anybody who's used thumb drives for this kind of purpose, eventually. So it's good because you have three copies, so if one dies, not the end of the world. But you might want to look, and they're not very expensive, invest in an external hard drive. Those tend to be more reliable than thumb drives.
Yeah, that's one of the places that I have them.
Good. Yeah, and then remember, we want three copies, but we also want to get one off-site. Take one to work. So what you can do is you can rotate them every week, on Monday when you go into work, take one of the drives to work and just rotate them. And that way you'll always have one off site, and that's really important.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you, Michelle.
Nice to talk to you.
I love those questions, and I think sometimes people have said, well, I don't want to sound dumb. I'm not going to ask them the difference between a spinning drive and an SSD, whatever. But I think that's something a lot of people don't know, and it's a useful thing to understand. And it helps you understand why an SSD might be a better choice for you. But I guess what I was getting to is any one component doesn't speed up. I mean, it's all the components together. It's a holistic unit that make a computer fast or slow. So if you have a slow computer, sometimes putting in an SSD will make it, it should make it faster, but not always. Depends on other components in that computer. But generally speaking, it's important to consider everything. And one thing people often don't consider is the speed of disk reads and writes. That's one of the things your computer spends a long time waiting for. It's one of the reasons we often tell people if you're going to buy a new computer these days, you probably want an SSD. There was some concern initially that they may not be as reliable, that they might wear out faster. But I think now that we've been using them for some time, I don't think that that's the case. I think we're all pretty comfortable with the fact that they're at least as reliable as spinning drives. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. On we go with the calls. Mike in Woodland Hills, California. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
Wonderful. How are you?
Good. You know, I want to say something first. It's really interesting hearing you on hold to talk about squishy chairs that you take naps in. I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, we have to do some special programming for those people who are kept on hold for so very long. We entertain them.
It's fun. It kind of makes me feel special that not all the world gets to hear that.
I could give you music on hold, but this is better, isn't it?
Much better.
I have to remember there are people listening. What can I do for you today?
Well, I have written a middle grade novel, and I have this great marketing opportunity to work with the Los Angeles Sparks. But first, what they want to do is a beta test of my book, and they want by getting it into the hands of like 200 of Los Angeles school students.
Oh, neat.
To find out how they feel about it.
So the Sparks is Los Angeles WNBA team, Women's National Basketball Association team.
Yes.
So is your book about basketball?
Well, it's about wishes, and one of them deals with the WNBA.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, so what they want to do is they want to get the book into through the school's readers. A lot of the readers have been donated to the Los Angeles school system, and so a lot of these students have access to the readers. So I want to be able to get that out to the students we choose, the 200, but not to the world, because it's going to be free for the students, and I just, you know, we're just doing a small test.
So you want to make your book an e-book, and what you're saying you want to do is copy protected.
Yes.
So that it can't be passed around.
Correct. And also only to just 200 students. That, you know, do they need a password? I'm kind of new to all this. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. My initial reaction is I'm against copy protection in general. A lot of publishers disagree with that position. But it's been my experience, and I can give you a lot of experiences, including the very famous novelist Paulo Coelho, who couldn't get anybody to publish his book, The Alchemist, so he gave it away, self-published it. And it became a bestseller, of course, and he's become a very successful novelist. And I know many writers who, in fact, give their books away. So my initial reaction would be don't copy protect it, but I understand why you do.
Once we have this and it goes through their beta test, and of course all the students are going to love it, then we're going to be giving away copies of the books by the thousands through the WNBA.
Oh, so you're interested in protecting it more because it's not ready yet, or?
Well, just because we have to do this small test of students to find out what they like before they involve any kind of monies and, you know, or sponsors.
So the sparks are driving the copy protection more than anything else.
Yes.
Yeah. So here's why I am not in favor of DRM. It often impedes the legal user, and it's easy for bad guys to remove. There is no ebook copy protection known that can't be easily removed. Mm-hmm. So it's of dubious value. And this is true of music and all kinds of copy protection, video games. On the other hand, I understand you want to get the sparks involved. So, and they're saying, well, we don't want this distributed widely until we're ready for it.
Right, yeah. We just want to make it easy for these students to be able to get the book. I mean, is it a PDF?
First of all, it's easy to make an e-book out of it. You already have digital files unless you wrote it on a typewriter.
No, I've got it on Word.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a great program called Caliber, C-A-L-I-B-R-E, Caliber, and that's free and allow you to convert it into any e-book format. Amazon uses Mobi. There's a kind of more standard EPUB format that almost any reader can use. I don't know what kind of readers your kids have, but if EPUB would probably be what you'd put it in. You don't want PDF. It's true that most readers can handle PDF, but formatting is not well done in PDFs.
Okay.
So you could put – anyway, Caliber will let you put it in any format you want. You can add ebook protection. There are companies like Lock Lizard, aptly named locklizard.com, that will sell you software that will lock your ebooks. It would probably be sufficient against middle schoolers. First of all, you're going to say to the middle schoolers, please don't pass this around. You're getting some special access to this book, and we want to keep it a surprise for the kids who are going to read it later. So, you know, frankly, passing stuff around is a great way to promote things, but okay.
How do I get it to just those students, though? What do they need to have access to my book?
Well, it depends what copy protection scheme you use. If you use Lock Lizard, there, and this is the other problem, DRM is really complicates it because now you have to authenticate. This is exactly the question: How do I keep people from stealing my books, and at the same time give it access to certain people?
Mm-hmm.
Well, password's not going to be good because anybody who has the book will have the password, which means it's not protected, right?
Right.
So you need to have an authentic. This is why I don't recommend it. You need to have an authentication server that they log into with an account that verifies them. You could probably, I mean, it's going to depend on what program you choose. If you go to Lock Lizard, they'll explain how you have to do this.
Okay.
It gets very complicated. And it makes the book much less accessible.
Yeah.
So if you can talk the sparks and give them this tape. I mean, this isn't what you want. You want to make it widely available. You tell the kids, please don't pass it around. You're getting an early review copy of it. I get copies of books all the time from publishers to say, you know, this is a galley. Don't pass it around. This is for review purposes only. And they just have to, you know, there's a little bit of trust involved, but I think that's appropriate. If you gave them a printed book, they could give it to other people, right?
Right. We're trying to avoid costs like that because right now.
No, ebook is better, but it's the cost is DRM.
Okay.
Don't put copy protection on it.
If I didn't have it protected then, and then each of these students wanted to gain access to it, is it just, how would that?
Oh, that's easy. You just put it on a website, they can download it.
Okay, so they would just be directed to a particular...
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to work with the school because most schools will prohibit kids from arbitrarily downloading files from the outside world. So it may end up being you go to the school, practically almost certainly will be you go to the school and the school will hand out, you know, we'll put it on their local server and the kids will be able to get it that way.
That sounds well. That's kind of like I was thinking. And if I had it in EPUB, then most likely that'll be compatible with the school system.
Yeah, Well, you just you have to find out what kind of readers they use. But EPUB is a standard. Almost everything will read. If they have Kindles, then you put in Mobi. If they have, they probably have I don't know what they have. They have iPads. They might have Kobos. I don't know what they have. But
yeah, I don't know.
Caliber will let you put it in any known format.
Okay.
So you can ask the school, what format would you like? And then, great, okay. here's your Mobi format. The nice thing about doing this digitally is it costs you nothing,
right?
Little time, and the kids prefer it in all likelihood, right? They can read it on their device.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is converting it to Caliber, is that an easy thing for me to do?
Yeah. Caliber is just a program. Yeah, you'll have the Word files on your hard drive. You'll download Caliber. Works on all kinds of computers, Macs, Windows, and Linux. You download it. You open up your book. You can look at it. You can play with the formatting if you want to, you know, make it different in some way, the fonts. And then you can actually say, convert this to EPUB, and it'll do it for you. Then I would recommend opening it with, you know, download the Kindle Reader software, for instance, on your computer, and open that EPUB. Make sure the formatting, the page breaks, and everything match your expectations. It's very easy to do.
Good. Well, I called you years ago about a website to put together for this, and I listened to you every single
week.
You're
getting there. What's the name of the book?
It's called Matthew Patterson and the Wish Keepers.
I love it. Well, good luck. That's exciting.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. And I don't know if I mentioned them, but I will mention my friend Guy Kawasaki's book. It's called The Ape Book, Author, Publisher, Entrepreneur. And it's about self-publishing and about formats and about all of this stuff and why you might not want to use copy protection, all of that stuff. It's apethebook.com. Okay. Author, Publisher, Entrepreneur, How to Publish a Book. And Guy is, you know, he was the original Apple evangelist. He's a brilliant entrepreneur, and he has written the book for anybody who wants to self-publish and find out, you know, the easy
ways. I will look it up.
Highly recommend it. He says, traditional publishers, your days are numbered. And, you know, I don't think that's true. I hope it's not true. But as somebody who's written many books myself, 13, I think, at last count, I think nowadays I would absolutely look at self-publishing. You don't make a lot of money writing a book, so why give a big chunk of it to a publisher? What do they do for you, you know, that you can't do yourself? 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, and we'll put links to Caliber and all the information I mentioned at our website. That's free and available at techguylabs.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches. Actually, our photographic guru, Chris Marquardt, will join us in just a few minutes to talk about taking better pictures. But meanwhile, let's go on with the calls. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Paul in Los Angeles, you're next. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome. What can I do for you?
Love your show.
Thank you. You're very kind.
Got a quick question about alarm systems.
Okay.
Need your education.
Okay. You want to get one?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what do you want to know what the best one is? I am not an expert on. I can tell you about some different angles you can take. Of course, you could go to an alarm company. And I'm sure there's several in your town. You live in a fairly big town called Los Angeles. Bay Alarm, those kinds of companies. And they come in, they install sensors. They'll connect to your phone line because they need to be able to reach police. They may put in a big siren. And then they will charge you a monthly fee for monitoring. I think in almost all of the cases we've tried several both at home and at work, they're all about the same in that respect. They'll have an emergency button you can press if, you know, you're being held hostage and things like that. So those are the more expensive solution because, of course, an installer costs money and the monthly fees cost money. And then there are do-it-yourself systems. We had a sponsor called SimpliSafe that's probably the best known of those. And the idea of SimpliSafe is you get the same sensors, all the same stuff. You even, you know, they've added cameras and so forth. window motion sensors, window opening sensors, door opening sensors, and they connect up to a hub that then can be connected to your phone system. They also offer monitoring. It's a little less expensive, A, because you're installing it yourself, and B, because they're trying to undercut the big name brand companies. Although it's my understanding the monitoring companies are pretty much the same. It's the same people answering the phones. So it's probably just as good. So that would be another option. And then there's the third option, which is totally do-it-yourself, minus monitoring. You just keep an eye on things. And there are many companies that offer cameras and alarms that you could put in your house, motion sensors. We have a sponsor that makes a doorbell, the Ring video doorbell, that has a camera on the doorbell. And then they also sell cameras you could put around the outside of your house. I've used, on the inside, I've used cameras from a Google company called Nest, and they're quite good. In fact, there's one right behind me. I don't know if you can see it, but there's one right behind me. It's called the Nest IQ Cam. And the idea of this camera is it's smart. It has facial recognition. So you put it in your house, it's watching, and whenever it sees somebody it doesn't know, it'll send you an alert on your phone. That's very handy. It can even recognize the dog and the cat, so it doesn't alert you that the cat's in the house, unless you want it to. Nest also sells, fairly expensively, I think it's $10 a month, the ability to record on their servers. That's nice because you can have a system at home that's totally your own that records locally. But the nice thing about the Nest stuff is you can check back. You don't have to run a big server and big hard drives, and set the technical issues are simpler. And you can then go online at your Nest site and see motion. They've even got time lapse. You can go back in time. They put little dots on the timeline whenever there's movement. Nest also has outdoor cameras, much like the Ring outdoor cameras, that will hear voices and let you talk to people, which can be useful for chasing people off. So those are kind of the levels. What's your inclination? Which direction do you want to go?
I was thinking between the HomeSafe, the Ring, and the Nest.
Yeah. So these are do-it-yourself solutions. Yeah. Well, I Ring is a sponsor again. I'll make that disclaimer. But I think Ring is the best video doorbell. If one of the things you want is a doorbell, the Ring is great. In fact, I can even on my Echo Show, which has a screen, I can say show my front door. It'll show my front door camera. You can talk to people. It has motion detection. And then they sell fairly inexpensively two kinds of cameras. One they call the stick-up cam, which doesn't require any power. It has a little solar panel. So it's just using Wi-Fi. And that's kind of nice. It has similar features. It has a camera. It has a night vision. All of these have night vision, which is important because most of the time what you're watching is what's happening after dark. The Nest does very well with night vision. The Nest has a very bright, I can't remember if it's infrared or ultraviolet. It's not visible to the human eye, but the camera can see it. And so it illuminates everything within 100 feet of the camera. So you can really see what's going on as if you're using, kind of military grade night vision. I like the Nest a lot. I think the Nest outdoor cameras are very nice and the indoor cameras are very nice. They're very expensive, especially if you include that monthly.
Compatible with Ring?
Yeah. Well, so compatible is an interesting. Yes, they can work fine with Ring, and I can both ask for pictures from my Nest camera and my Ring camera on my Echo. I guess compatible means I'm not sure what that means. There's not a unified. You can have them. You can have mix and match, of course, but there's no unified hub that you can go to. For Ring, you'll have to go to the Ring site to see what's going on, or use the Ring app. For Nest, you'll use the Nest app or go to the Nest site to see what's going on. If you wanted, I don't think Nest offers a doorbell. So if you wanted one app and one site, then you'd probably go all Ring. But they work quite well. Remember, you have to have Wi-Fi. The Rings are actually a little bit easier on the Wi-Fi because they turn off when nothing's going on. The Nests are on all the time, sending pictures to the server, and that can use up a lot of bandwidth. The Nest IQ cams let you say, I don't want to use more than 100 gigabytes a month. But it's important to remember, they're sending a high-definition picture of your indoors or outdoors, and that does use up Wi-Fi bandwidth, and it can use up your total bandwidth as well over a period of time. So if you have a lot of Nest cams, you're going to have to be careful about bandwidth. In that respect, I think Ring has an advantage because they're not on unless something's happening.
Does Ring also offer monitoring? Like, so if we're on vacation and the phone doesn't ring.
No. Yeah. Neither Ring nor Nest have call centers, but they do notify you on the phone. So when there's – and you can set up parameters on the Ring cameras, and this is true on the Nest as well. I could say monitor this zone, and if there's any movement in this area, so I have it monitoring particularly the driveway to my house. I don't care what's going on in the field next to it, but the driveway to the house, I say monitor this zone. And if there's movement there, I want a notification on my phone. So you're the call center. If you want third party to be monitoring it, that's a little more expensive. You have to go to a company monitoring it, and they're going to want to install their own cameras and so forth. Dr. Mom's reminding me that some hubs, like the SmartThings hub from Samsung, will talk to both the Ring and the Nest. The Amazon Echo will also talk to both of them. So in that sense, they're compatible. If you want monitoring, though, I think you're going to go to a service. If you want a call center.
Yeah, because if we're away, you know, on vacation when we travel, or if we go to dinner and I don't like to bring my phone in with me.
Yeah, then you might. Yeah, but then see, a monitoring service is still going to call you. So before they dispatch the police, they're going to call you and say, hey, there's some activity at your house. I know this because we had in our business, we had Bay Alarm, and I would get calls every night, and it turned out there was a faulty sensor. And I spent a few early morning hours over at the business talking to the police saying, yeah, there's nothing, sorry. After a while, the police start to say, we're going to charge you for this the next time. So they'll still call you. You need to keep, if that's what you want to do, you need to keep your cell phone with you, I think. I do feel like these companies, these alarm service companies, are going to face a real challenge from companies like Simply Safe and Nest and Ring. More and more people are doing it themselves. And mostly that's because you can control it yourself. I don't really think you need the monitoring, because even with monitoring, they're going to call you. They're not going to just call the police right away, unless there's like they can look at the camera and the house is burning down. Then they might call the fire department. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. User 4654 in the chat room is telling me, and I didn't know this, you might want to contact the local police department, what their policies are on alarm company notifications. Apparently, the LAPD, I haven't verified this, but according to one of our chatters, does not respond any longer to alarm company calls. They quit several years ago. So he's turned to using Netgear Arlo cameras, which are also very good, and he makes the call because they will respond to a homeowner calling. That's interesting. I guess that's probably because there were so many false alarms. It costs a lot of money for police departments to respond to all these false alarms. 8888 Ask Leo. I don't know if that's the case, but it might be worth calling your local police department, not on the 911 number, but on their business number, and ask them what their policy is before you invest a lot of money in something like that. Lot in Fort Lauderdale, California. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, I believe. Hi, Lot. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi there, Leo, and good afternoon
good
to
afternoon.
You. Okay, my question is TiVo. Unfortunately, I've been having trouble with one particular TiVo unit that I have, and this has been dragging on for like 9 weeks.
What's the trouble you're having?
It's a Series 3, and I've been ordered by TiVo through their, you know, data download that I had to do an update.
Yeah.
And I did an update.
Yeah.
And what happens is I have it connected to an outdoor antenna plus the cable. So I also have a cable card with this particular TiVo. And it sets up the cable fine. When it starts scanning the TV channels, it freezes at channel 24.
Ugh.
And then the unit shuts off and reboots itself back down, and then you have to start all over again. And you have to start all over again.
And so have you called TiVo and told them this, that your update just screwed up my TiVo?
Yeah, they're aware of it. They admitted to me.
They said, we know about this?
But it's 9 weeks already.
Well, the TiVo Series 3 is pretty old. And it may be.
So am I.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I had a Series 3. I loved it. But they probably feel like, well, we're not going to really support this anymore. That's annoying. You wouldn't want an update pushed to a computer that broke the computer. Same thing with a TiVo. I presume you've done the one thing, the only thing I know to do with a TiVo, which is to reset it, you know, go back to factory settings.
Absolutely, I tried that too.
And if it doesn't fix it, it means that that update that they pushed is incompatible with the Series 3.
Correct.
Which is very frustrating.
Anyway, it's time for me to pack my bags and move on to from TiVo.
I think so. I don't blame you.
I'm open to suggestions. What do you recommend?
I use the latest TiVo, and I like it a lot. But one negative about TiVo is, of course, this monthly or, in my case, lifetime fee you pay, which is a lot of money, hundreds of dollars, for the channel guide. And I think I've kind of blew it because I have a bunch of TiVos and I bought lifetime subscriptions to the channel guide, but they're not going to work if I cord cut. They really are designed to work with the cable box. And I have a feeling that it's one of the things keeping me from firing my cable company is this ridiculous investment I have in TiVos. So maybe it would be prudent to look at something that doesn't have a big cost for the channel guide. And for that, I would look at Channel Master. They make basically their DVRs. They're better than much better than the cable company's DVRs. I would argue that TiVo is the best DVR still, despite this annoying update.
Right. By the way, the newer TiVos do not do cable or over the air. It's one or the other, not both.
That's right.
Sorry.
That's what I have. See, that's why I can't I can't cut the cord because I have cable card TiVos. And I can't use them with an over the air, so and all the money I paid for the channel guide will be worthless if I'm not paying for cable. So
and way back when you told me how to straighten out my over the air antenna and get more channels.
Good.
I remember calling
so you're a
that.
Prime candidate to be a cord cutter. Channel Master works with OTA.
Okay, so that's what I think I'm going to do. I'm going to invest in buying a channel master.
Yeah.
And
the other one that a lot of the people in the chat room always mention is the HD Home Run from Silicon Dust. That's really more for connecting to a computer and using your computer as a DVR, although I think they offer DVR stuff. But I would look at the two. But people who use Channel Master love it. It is really the only credible competition at this point for TiVo.
Okay, that's fine. By the way, TiVo, I know, was sold, and the company relocated and took their support team to a strange place in a strange land.
Rovi, the company that bought TiVo, said at the time they bought it, we're not that interested in the hardware. That caused my stomach to jump because I'm very interested in the hardware. I'm thousands of dollars interested in the hardware. And so I'm dreading the future. And boy, what you just told me is a bad indication.
I also have four other TiVos, but they're the Series 4. So I guess as they go, it's goodbye. And that
I bought brand new bolts, and they're great. But by the way, we also got that update. They changed their UI considerably. They changed everything. Take a look at the Channel Master. There's no subscription for the channel guide. It will work with OTA over the air with your antenna. And frankly, because you get good channels, you get good over the air coverage, I think you're a prime candidate for instead of.
Yeah, there's seven. Here in Fort Lauderdale, there's 70 over the air channels.
Oh, that's awesome.
Crystal clear.
That's awesome. So use your OTA antenna, use the Channel Master to record those.
Right.
And then if you need additional stuff, you can buy Showtime or HBO or Netflix All right?
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
And one other thing before you go, I want to just thank Heather for believing in my first name because it's
well,
a weird first name.
We're all Ronnie Lott fans here. So if you – just because, you took the first – you took – Lott, L-O-T-T?
Yes.
Well, that's a biblical name. Of course she believes it. You, and just don't look at your wife when you're running away because you could turn.
I know she'll turn into Diamond Crystal.
Yes. Uh-huh, oh, nice. Already. Oh, fancy. Yeah, you've heard that once or twice, haven't you?
Yeah.
Once or twice.
By the way, I went to school in Rhode Island, so I went to college there.
You went to URI or RISD or
BC? No, Roger Williams University.
Roger Williams.
Crystal.
Great school.
I lived in Barrington and I taught in Providence, Rhode Island, Second
nice.
Street Elementary School.
Oh, my goodness. I went to John Howland School in Providence, but that was back in the 60s, and they've torn it down. I've gone back to visit, and there's just a bunch of condos there. It's very sad. It's nice to talk to you a lot.
Next year, the July 4th parade in Bristol.
Oh, what fun.
There are other people.
Oh, what fun. Nah, I'm having fun talking to you. Thank you a lot.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you,
Heather, for believing in me.
She believed. I believed in you. Heather's covering her face. Why?
Of course
you believe in him. Why wouldn't you? Did you say you didn't at first? You said, what? Lott? Is that your name?
He goes, my last name is Money. And I was like, what with that? That's not funny.
A lot of money. Is his wife's name Lotta?
Right.
Lot and Lotta.
Middle initial A, yeah.
A lot of money. That's hysterical. Is that really his last name?
That's what he said.
No.
And then he said, don't blame me. My parents named me that, blah, blah, blah.
I wonder if his sister's named Lotta. That's funny. Bags full.
Or Outa.
Outa. Heather Hammond. It's nice to have you. It's good to see you. Thank you for
being here on
thank
a Sunday.
You for spending
I'm
a Sunday.
For this, you know.
Why don't I believe that? 8888 Ask Leah if you want to talk to Heather and then talk to me. 888-827-5536. John tells me the reason that our alarm system went off in the studio all the time is we had a disco ball. And the lights, it would rotate, and the reflection, it would set off the alarm. So we got rid of the disco ball, and everything works. It's time once again for Chris Marquardt, our photo guy. Chris is a photographer, leads wonderful workshops at discoverthetopfloor.com, hosts one of the best photography podcasts I know of, Tips from the Top Floor, and he joins us every week to help us get better photos. John brought in, John, my studio manager, is all excited because he's going up to Oregon in 3 weeks, 4 weeks for the total eclipse.
And on the 21st.
On the 21st. He's got all of the times and the angles and all of that stuff. So he knows exactly at 10:20:57 a.m. it'll be at solar max and it'll stay there for 2 minutes and 4 seconds. So
that's not too bad.
He's ordered the lens. Well, he's borrowing my 70-200 lens plus a 2X extender, right? So he can go up to 400. And he's already ordered the neutral density filter to protect his eyes and the camera from the sun's rays. It's a ND1000.
Mm-hmm.
So you can barely see through it. But we were talking about filters, and he said he paid $15 for this. And you said you can buy $200 ND.
Oh yes, you can. Yes, yeah. You can.
Is there a difference?
Filters. It comes usually down to how straight they are and how well they are coated. The coating, the non-reflective coating on the filters. Multi-coated filters are more expensive than single-coated filters, or uncoated filters, and that in turn might influence how the reflections work out, like stuff coming in through the filter onto the front element being reflected back out and back in through the filter, which might in some situations give you ghost images. So there's I'm not a fan of filters.
Well, and this came up.
Unless they are like that filter. I mean, for the sun, you will need that ND filter. You will need to
be a filter, right.
You have to have a filter, and then it's always a question if that's a once in a lifetime kind of use. What are you going to do? Are you going to spend a lot of money or not? I would say give it a shot, give it a try. You can practice that on the actual sun
because you can do it again in 20 years. Eclipse. Oh, I guess you're right. You could try it now before the eclipse.
You should try it now and see if it comes out well, and then
to get a new one. Yeah,
there's a good chance that might just be fine.
So,
yeah.
I give you another example. I have a very expensive point-and-shoot camera from Leica. It cost me thousands of dollars, the Leica Q. I love this. I love this. My baby. I love this camera. And when I bought it on the recommendation of a photo blogger, I bought a haze filter to protect the lens, right? And now I'm looking at it, and I only paid $20 for this haze filter. And now I'm thinking, I probably should take it off. I mean, this is a very fancy lens. It's like a lens. Am I ruining my pictures with this filter?
Well, again, it depends on the filter. In most cases, if it's not one of the real cheap ones, should be fine.
$20 seems pretty cheap.
But I'm usually the filters that I put on are in the range of $100 or more.
Okay, so I'm taking it off. But then am I at risk of scratching the lens? That's why
I'm very unpopular for saying that I don't really recommend filters on the lens to protect them, but instead use a lens hood, which will keep a lot of stuff off the lens. If you scratch the front element of the lens, first of all, there's still a good chance you won't see the problem with that, and second, that can be repaired.
And
that
you can see, replaced, so. I do have a nice metal, this camera comes with a beautiful metal screw-on lens hood, and it's dinged the heck up. All over it.
I recommend a video that I found on YouTube a while ago by a photographer called Steve Perry, P E R R why UV filters, do you need them or not? He has smashed a whole bunch of filters that he bought, a whole bunch of lenses, and looked at how much force do you need to smash a filter versus smashing a lens. His conclusion is very interesting, so I recommend people watch that to make up their own mind about okay. if such a filter is important or not.
Didn't mean to hijack your segment, but we were talking
because
eclipse is coming, and I know people want to be prepared. Right?
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
This is a B&W MRC filter, which I'm told is a good quality filter.
But B&W. German product. Of course it's good.
Yeah. It's got to be great. Great. So what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I've just returned from a really exciting week. This is the once-a-year workshop that I hold in an old abbey in southern Germany. This time we were there with 27 people in the Danube Valley. And one of the things people do there that we kind of guide them through are projects, little photo projects that take the entire week. They will spend 5 days on these projects and then present them. And a few of those little projects, I think, are something that people can do at home. And so I want to run you through just five different of those projects, not from this week, but from other weeks. And I think they're really... really cool to kind of get your creative juices flowing. And so here are five of them. First of all, shoot the mundane.
Find boring stuff in your backyard.
That's what this is about. Find boring stuff in your backyard, around the house. Just stuff that doesn't look interesting, and try to make it look interesting. And do this on a regular basis, and you will become a better photographer. Second, shoot through things. Just stuff that you can look through. Maybe a pair of sunglasses or an orange Tic Tac box. Wonderful to play with. Or in winter, take a slab of ice and use that between your camera and what you're shooting. That will add a lot of interest to a photo. You can, while we're talking about ice, you can freeze things. I've seen people freeze flowers in water in the fridge or in the freezer. You might want to use like distilled water to help keep the bubbles out, and then shoot that with a flash that you take off the camera so it doesn't come straight from the camera. It makes for very interesting light. And the fifth one, which I find really, really helpful, is, and it's painful at the beginning, but if you do it a while, it'll actually be really helpful, is taking the wrong lens for the job. If you think, I want to do portraits. I need a longer lens for that to make a nice bokeh, a nice out-of-focus background.
Yeah.
You do that with a wide-angle lens, or go to the zoo with a wide-angle lens instead of your telephoto lens, because that will force you outside your comfort zone. That will force you to think outside the box and do things that you would never do. You would never go and shoot those lions in the zoo with 24 millimeters. You'd probably use 200 millimeters or 300 millimeters
for
that.
So this is about breaking out of your conceptual box, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Take the wrong tool for the job, and that could be anything in your photography, but lenses are pretty much a prime example there. Take the wrong lens for the job. Landscape photography, you might want to go wide angle. Hey, just bring the telephoto lens for an entire weekend for landscape photography. You'll be surprised.
That sounds like fun. Yeah, is this encoded anywhere? Do you have a website or anywhere I can?
No, you'll find a lot of these kind of little hints online if you Google photography projects. A sixth one that I really recommend is, these 360 projects where people want to go out every day and shoot a photo every day of a year, which is like, oh wow, that's a long time frame to do. Try the 50 by 50 by 50 project. Take 50 pictures on 50 consecutive days using only a 50-millimeter lens.
Ooh, the nifty 50.
And that for 50 days, 50 photos, that's kind of that's under 2 months, so you can really kind of do it. And then a bonus, put the results of your project in a photo book and then give that to someone you like.
Oh, I love it. Better than a mixtape. Chris Marquardt, you'll find him at discoverthetopfloor.com and here every week helping us. What's our assignment this week? I forgot.
Ooh, the assignment is joy.
Joy.
J-O-Y. Joy.
Take a picture illustrating the word or concept joy. Tag it with the word joy and upload it to our Flickr group, the Tech Guy group on Flickr. And we're actually on a couple of weeks out from an assignment review. Chris will pick three and talk about them on the radio. Thank you, Chris. Leo Laporte.
Absolutely.
The Tech Guy. More calls right after this. Back to the phones we go. And Burke on the line from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Burke.
Hello, Leo. How are you this
afternoon? I'm well. How are you?
Not too bad. Have a Canon camera. It's a... what? I forgot what the heck it was.
Is it an Elf?
Oh, it's a ZR65. I'm sorry.
ZR65. Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those mini DV.
Yeah.
It's, of course, old.
Casio, not Canon, right?
No, it's a Canon.
It's Canon, okay.
Mm-hmm. And it connects to the computer through FireWire.
Oh, which... Lord, Lord, Lord.
Oh, that's what I said.
Oh, Lordy, Lordy.
And when my old computer died, of course, I lost the FireWire.
Right.
Nobody makes them anymore.
Are you using Windows or Mac?
I'm using Windows 10.
Yeah, FireWire, which was a standard, was designed to replace something even older. Remember SCSI?
Yes.
So SCSI begat FireWire. It was a creation of Apple and Intel, and Apple really championed it for a long time. Sony also was part of the FireWire coalition, but Sony decided not to call it FireWire because Apple called it FireWire, so they called it the it just rolls off the tongue, IEEE 1365.
I've seen that too.
Or iLink on your camcorder. It'll say iLink if it's a Sony camcorder. Those right. are all the same. They're compatible. What you need is a converter, though, because nobody puts FireWire on their computers anymore.
Yeah, I've got a dead computer sitting here that I can plug it into, but nothing
will happen. The reason I asked if you're a Mac or PC is I just got a dock for a Mac from Otherworld Computing. It's a Thunderbolt 3 dock, so it only works with a couple of the newer Macs. It has, hysterically, a FireWire port on it, and that's obviously for downward compatibility to older yeah. stuff. So what you're going to do is you're going to monoprice.com, which is, I think, the best vendor of inexpensive components. They don't jack up the price. And you're going to search for FireWire to USB converter.
I have seen those. I've done a lot of looking. And the ones that I've found have not had real good reviews on them.
Well, and there's a reason. They're fundamentally different technologies.
Uh-huh.
FireWire is a peer-to-peer system. So FireWire can connect two computers, can connect two hard drives. It doesn't care.
Right.
USB requires a master controller and then a client. So they're very fundamentally different. But as long as what you want to do is connect a camcorder to a computer, a converter like that should work just fine.
I had seen some that were for sale. It was USB to FireWire.
Yeah.
And the reports on those, people were just cutting a USB off and taping gluing a FireWire on it and selling it. And
oh, that's terrible. I hope they're that's why I say go to Monoprice. Don't go to eBay. Don't even go to Amazon, mostly because, Amazon tries to police this, but it's so big it can't always catch this. And right. so they may sell stuff that is like that. Yeah, you definitely don't want to buy that. But if okay. you find something at monoprice.com that'll do it, it's going to probably – I'm just looking to see if I can find one. Yeah, it's going to cost a little – well, maybe not that much. This is – that's a FireWire. No, that's not quite it. Maybe, here's a link to a company called StarTech. That's it from the chat room. PC Guy 8088.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah. You don't want that. That's is it a tower PC?
No, right now I'm running off an HP laptop.
Laptop, yeah. So what he put in there was a card you could put in a slot that would add FireWire ports to your computer. That actually wouldn't be a bad way to go if you're going to be getting... Is this a one-time deal, or you want to keep using this Canon camcorder?
Well, I want to keep using it. I spent a lot of money. I've got a lot of tapes. And
Yeah, it's a good camcorder. It's just got that. It's the problem is just that interface.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think that I'm looking here. I'm looking for a converter, USB FireWire converter. And I tell you what, this is not. I'm sure they have something there. And if you buy it from Mono Price, they stand behind their stuff. So
okay.
It's not going to be
Mono.
Mono, M-O-N-O, Price, P-R-I-C-E.
Okay, I can certainly look there.
Yeah. I think that, you know, they're certainly not going to sell something that's a USB cable clipped off and stuck glued onto it. IEEE 1394 interface. There may be, somebody's saying there might be an issue with the connection on the computer. That I don't know about. This is interesting. You know what? I should know more about this, but I don't. Let me do a little research. We'll put it in the show notes for you, okay?
Yeah,
this,
that sounds great.
Yeah, this is something you can do. You're right to avoid the, you know, this is the kind of thing you don't want to buy on eBay because there are people on there who'll sell stuff that's just not, doesn't work.
Yeah, and I'd never heard of Mono Price. So.
Yeah, I love them for cables, for everything. They're good costs and quality gear.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Good to hear.
Thanks for the call, Burke.
Yeah, one more thing.
Sure.
Listening to Chris, I don't do a whole lot with my pictures, but every now and then I get a picture that Google Photos has sent me that's enhanced. And
yes.
it looks really good.
Ah.
How can I do that? They just send them randomly.
What they're doing on the enhanced is really something called HDR, or high dynamic range. And I don't know if there's a – I'm pretty sure there is a button. You're going to have to go deeper down in the photos settings on Google Photos to get to it that will give you that filter. And there's sliders that can turn the effect up. And I notice when I get enhanced images, they've really turned the effect up. They like to really enhance the heck out of those.
Yeah, they did. Some of them look kind of
painter, almost painterly, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's HDR. You can of course go out and get a standalone HDR program. Yeah, no, actually, you know what? I'm wrong. They do not offer in their editing tools anything nearly as strong as they offer with that enhanced thing. How can you force Google to do an enhanced? I don't know. That's a good question. But if you like that look, there are certainly some great programs out there that will do HDRs. It will take an image and allow you to do that kind of painterly look to it. My friend Trey Ratcliffe is the king of HDR photography. His website, stuckincustoms.com, talks about some of the programs. He actually has created one that's for the Mac only, I'm sorry to say, called Aurora HDR from Mac Fun. But on the PC, I use something called Photomatix that will do this. But it's expensive. I think it's a $100 program. So
wow.
Let's see if we can figure out. Now you're giving me two assignments. Let's see if we can. No, I appreciate it. That's how I learn. When I don't know an answer, I have to figure it out. So let's figure out how we can force. I think there must be a way to tell Google Photos, hey, make this one enhanced. Because you're right. It's just random, isn't it?
Every now and then say, hey, how you like this? And send me a picture. And I really like that one.
Yeah.
And this one, not so much.
It's HDR pretty much when I've received that. It's an HDR photo.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but I don't know.
So they're sending you stuff like that too,
Oh,
right?
Yeah. It's the assistant. And it's actually awesome. They'll do animated GIFs if you take three photos real quickly together. And then, from time to time, it tends to be more landscapes. They'll send me that enhanced pictures. And I like those. They're good. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Great. Hey, I appreciate the questions. I've got two of them. I will find you a USB to FireWire converter that you could trust. And I will figure out how you could force Google to enhance your photos with that HDR. Well, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, self-driving cars, all of the gizmos and gadgets of the 21st century that are changing our lives for good or ill. That's what we talk about on this show. My phone number, 888-827-5536, 8888-ASK-LEO. The website, techguylabs.com. And for our last caller, I put a link up to a program, I think it's free, from Topaz Labs. Windows or Mac. That's a really nice photo editor, simple, easy-to-use photo editor that lets you get a lot of those HDR and artistic effects that Google Photos does for you automatically, but you're in a lot more control of it. It's called Topaz Studio. Topaz makes their money from plugins that pro photographers will use in Lightroom or Photoshop. But they also now offer a front end to those plugins, Topaz Studio. And I think the front end is free and has a lot of basic effects for free, including some nice high dynamic range or HDR effects. If you're starting to look at what Google Photos is doing with your pictures and you think, I'd like to do some more with my pictures, that's a good place to start. TopazLabs.com. And that is free. I was playing with the settings and the filters and so forth that Google offers you in Google Photos, and it's still not as complete as Picasa, which is what it's based on. Google bought Picasa, absorbed it, and then kind of put it out of business. And I was hoping that they would include those features in the built-in web editor. And they have some, but not all. Another good choice, Loquacious reminded me, is that Google is giving away its Nik collection. Unfortunately, I guess you can use those standalone. Nik was another company that Google bought, put out of business. They made great filters for, again, Photoshop and Lightroom, for mostly professional or at least certainly serious photography enthusiasts. And Google bought them not for their filters, but for the application they made for iOS and Android called Snapseed. And they offer that still for free. It's wonderful. And if you're on a phone and you actually, that I should have probably mentioned, is a must-have for anybody who's doing camera phone photography and wants to kind of get to the next level with it. Download Snapseed. It's absolutely free from Google, and it has a lot of the effects and filters that you're probably looking for. Some of my absolute favorite pictures I edited with Snapseed, of all things, because it's based on Nik. Google has stopped updating the Nik plugins, but they do offer them for free at Nik. I think it's niksoftware.com. N-I-K. N-I-K. So there, you know, if you want to get serious about photography, of course, the first step is, as Chris Marquardt is always encouraging you to do, take more pictures. But the next step is get those pictures on your computer and maybe learn how to adjust them and modify them. Almost all professionals do this. It's rare you will see a picture that grabs your eye that hasn't been at least a little bit tweaked. And they use tools like this, Snapseed, the Nik software, and Topaz Studio. And Topaz has, the reason Topaz gives a studio away, they're hoping you'll buy their filters. And you know what? You probably will, because they're great. A lot of great choices out there. And it's sad that Google isn't keeping Picasa, you know, putting it out there, and they're not incorporating those features in. But there's still, if you're serious about it, there's still plenty of ways you can do it. Still working, though, on his second question. Actually, it was his first question, the FireWire. How do you connect FireWire to a modern computer? You know, they don't include FireWire anymore in most computers, and so it's challenging to get that working. But you should be able to find an adapter. I'll keep looking, see if I can find a recommended one. On we go to San Pedro, California. Laura is on the line. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you, Leo?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. My question is, I have car navigation in my car, and I got real-time traffic through SiriusXM, and it doesn't work maybe once in a blue moon.
I know. I stopped using that real-time traffic. It wasn't that reliable or useful, was it?
Oh, okay. Because they told me to check with the dealership to make sure that the software was updated, which I did, and they said it's fine.
You know what the best solution is? It's not in your car. And actually, if you think about it, that's not surprising. It takes a car manufacturer 5 years to design, build, and release a car. 5 years ago, what was computer technology like? Nowhere like it is today. So it's your phone that really has the smartest technology. Do you have a smartphone?
I do.
Go out and get, now you already have, I'm sure, Google Maps or Apple Maps on there. But if you want to be, if you want the best application for keeping up on what's ahead, what the traffic conditions are, not just traffic conditions, road hazards, speed traps, red light cameras, accidents, Google makes a free program called Waze, W-A-Z-E.
Okay. And I do have that, yeah.
Waze is far better than anything Sirius does or anything your car company is going to do because Google keeps it up to date. They don't have a five-year development cycle.
Oh, okay.
Now, that means, of course, you got to pair your car to your phone so that this directions come through the phone. And, you know, it's a little harder to use the screen on a phone than the screen on your car. But and also be very careful about getting distracted while you're doing it. But I know most of the commuters I know live and die by Waze. They've got it running every time. And because all what's happening is everybody else who's using Waze is contributing data every moment. So it knows exactly what the traffic's like ahead of you because people are driving ahead of you using Waze.
Okay. If I have, like, Apple CarPlay, will that come up on the screen then if I have Waze?
Yes.
Because I can do Google on my screen.
If you have Apple CarPlay, I believe Waze will show up. Yes.
Okay.
That's great. You're lucky to have that. This is Android Auto and Apple CarPlay are exactly the solution these car companies came up with. They said, and Apple and Google, well, if you don't update your car that often, what if we somehow make the phone interface better with the car? So that's keeping up to date. That way you get newer processors, newer software. Of course, for issues of distracted driving, it's a subset of everything that's on your phone. You can't play Candy Crush, obviously.
Of course.
For good reason. But I don't know. I'm surprised they don't. Oh, Waze is in beta for AirPlay and Android Auto. So it's not fully released yet, but what you probably could do is if you Google search for Waze beta, get in on the beta program on your phone, then it'll show up in your CarPlay.
Okay, cool.
And that is the best solution. Easily.
And I will cancel my SiriusXM real-time traffic.
Then. Yeah, I would. Because the real-time traffic is only getting it from official sources, which is good. Waze gets it from those sources and the thousands of commuters who are on the same road as you every single day. So it's more up-to-date. It's more accurate. Waze will also reroute you. If it says, oh, there's terrible traffic up ahead, let's take a back street. And sometimes people say, well, sometimes Waze gives you dumb ideas. Yeah, like, for instance, you're on a stop-and-go traffic on the freeway, and Waze says, take this exit and then get back on the freeway. Well, to a computer, that does speed you up, but that's, I mean, not much. It's a little annoying and it's probably annoying to everybody you're merging in with, and it's hard to do. So I ignore little improvements like that. But when Waze says, I can save you 20 minutes, get off here, I always do that. It'll be through the back roads, but I trust Waze. They do a very, very good job. Google Maps is getting some of the Waze information, but not all of it. But you can continue to use Google Maps. They do put traffic information on there and so forth. I think you're always better off using the nav apps on your phone. They're just more up to date than the nav apps on your car. When's the last time you got a map update for your car, right? If ever. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I tell you what, Waze, if you want to use my voice in Waze, you can use now your own voice, but I've made a little... It's nothing fancy, but I made a little thing with my own voice. Go to twit. We'll put this in the show notes. twit.to/LeoWaze. And you can install my voice giving you directions on Waze. Leo Laporte, silly. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Glad you're here today. Hope you're having some fun. I am. Sheila, Ontario, California. Hi, Sheila. You're next.
Hi, Leo. I've been listening to you for a long time.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I bought a Samsung TV, and naturally, as soon as the warranty wore out, my TV, went blank.
How do they do that? It's amazing. The timing is perfect.
Yeah. So I called them. They want $100 to come out here.
Yeah.
$100 to tell me what's wrong, and then plus parts. So I was being a smarty pants, and I said, so another $100, I'll just buy me a new TV.
Exactly.
Right? And I hung up on him.
Was it satisfying? Did it make you feel better?
Well, then I started calling around to the TV places, and a lot of them have gone out of business because they said they can't get the parts from
them. Yeah. This is the trick that big companies like Apple and Samsung play, is they want you to use authorized repair facilities, so they just don't offer parts.
Right.
Or manuals.
They're doing it to cars, too.
Yep. This is why there's a movement, the right to repair movement. And in at least in 12 states in this country, there's legislation up in front of the states that would mandate a right to repair. If it happens in just one state, it'll break the logjam because, of course, no company's going to say, well, we'll give manuals to Minnesota, but not anyone else. We'll sell parts in Minnesota only. So I'm hoping one of these legislatures approves this right to repair. If you Google right to repair, you'll see the conversation. And it does, it actually starts with tractor owners, John Deere Company, because they're worried.
Yeah,
the big combines, you know, the really expensive $1 million combines, they won't let you repair them because they're afraid of people stealing the software. So you have to go to official John Deere certified repair facility, and they, you know, it's all done in secret. And so that's really, I think, where the movement is happening the most, because it tends to be in the farm states that people are most up in arms over this. But it would absolutely affect Apple. And it would affect Samsung and all these other companies. They'd have to start selling parts and, more importantly, maybe manuals. So the truth about most modern thin screen, flat screen HD TVs is they're not very repairable. Unless you have a minor issue. That's the other reason. Yeah. They're not going to tell you this. The other reason those TV repair shops have gone out of business. They can fix a tube TV like nobody's business, but it's a little trickier. These things are they're like computers. They're just, it's all logic boards and panels. What are you going to replace, you know? Unless it's a connector that went bad, which in most cases it's not. Your TV's not getting moved around or anything. It's much more likely the panel that went bad, and it's true. It would cost more to replace that panel. You'd be out $200 to find out they want $800 to fix the TV.
Right.
And then you say, well, that's $1,000 and I could easily get a TV that's even better for less.
Right.
So your answer was actually the right answer, which is in most cases, you're better off just getting a new TV. Now, that TV isn't very old. It is out of warranty, but I'm told that Samsung has had some specific problems with some of their displays with capacitors, and in some cases, they've been repairing them out of warranty.
They're not going to do that here.
I guess not. They told you, right?
Yeah, they said, so sorry. They don't care. They, you know, why should they care? They're making millions. They don't care.
There is a few years ago, Gollum in our chat room sending me a link from 2012, there was a lawsuit against Samsung, or a class action lawsuit, because some of their TVs were failing due to a power defect. You said it's just a year old now, this TV?
A little over a year and a half old.
How big is it?
It's a 40.
Yeah. So you're right. That a 40-inch TV, HD TV, you could easily replace that for, you know, $500 or less, $300.
Yeah. Yeah, I bought it at Christmas time. It was on sale.
Yeah.
I'm sad because I watch a lot of TV, and now I got these dinosaurs here that I'm trying to get going, but I don't have cable, so I've been using like a regular TV antenna, and it was great. I loved it. I got all the PBS stations, and I was happy. I don't need cable.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it might be time for a new TV.
Yeah. You know what? Can I ask you one other thing about my Apple computer?
Yes.
I was going to go get it. I was just feeling, I don't know, and I was going to go get it like a tune-up, and a friend of mine told me, don't do that. They're going to try selling you a new computer. You think that's true?
Well, I mean, you're not a pushover, are you?
No, not really.
You can always
really.
Say no. You're going to take it to Apple for the tune-up?
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as you take it to Apple. I wouldn't take it anywhere else for a tune-up. But if Apple offers a tune-up, they're pretty good. They don't push too hard. They're not on commission. They're not going to push you too hard.
Yeah.
I think you can just say, well, no, I really like this. I love this computer. I don't want to buy a new one. Can you fix it? You may be able to do this yourself, by the way. I mean, with tune-up, what is a tune-up? I'm not sure, but probably what it would involve, and something you could easily do, is back up all your data. Because you don't want to lose anything that's on that hard drive. In fact, I would recommend you do that anyway before you absolutely do that before you bring it into the store. Always.
Uh-huh.
And then you could just reinstall the operating system. You can erase the hard drive, reinstall the operating system, reinstall your apps, and reinstall your data. And you're, that's better than any tune-up. That's a fresh start.
I really don't have that much on it.
Yeah, that's, you can do that yourself. And the nice thing about Apple, because they don't charge for the operating system, even if your computer, if you don't have a disk, how old is this Mac?
About 10 years old.
Ooh. That's pretty old.
I'm old.
Oh, it works fine, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, you might. That's that. They are going to try to get you to buy a new computer. I'm going to try to. No, I'm not. 10 years old. You're probably not even close to the newest operating system.
Yeah, I know they're trying to get me to buy a new phone too.
Yeah, the problem with a computer that is that old, it works just like it did when it came from the factory, but now you're doing more modern programs which demand more power and security. You're not getting the latest security updates because you probably can't, I'm thinking, can't run anything past Snow Leopard on it or something
yeah,
like that.
You're right.
You're on a pretty old version of Mac OS X, which means you're not.
I don't do very much on it. I just like, I don't do much on it. Honestly.
Yeah, and it works, right? Why do you want it tuned up?
Yeah, I watch a lot of just stuff.
Yeah, why do you want it tuned up? Is it slow?
No, not particularly, no.
It doesn't have any issues?
No. Yeah. Don't fix it if it's not broke.
Don't fix it if it's not broke, exactly. Keep it, you know, keep using it until it breaks or until it's just unbearably slow, and then you get a new one. The only issue is security updates. You're not getting the latest security updates by far. But you know what? That also is not that's such an old computer. It's not really a target either. So you're probably just fine, especially on a Mac. Yeah, keep using it. It's fine. Worry about your TV. Your Mac, it's fine. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. We are talking a little bit about the eclipse, which is coming in just a few weeks. It's everywhere in the United States. You should see some eclipse. The sky will definitely darken, and you'll get totality, which means the sun will be completely blocked by the shadow of the moon in a swath going from Oregon to Florida. So there's a lot of people wondering, well, how do I watch it? How do I look at it? And how do I photograph it? And I strongly encourage, and we'll actually give you a link in the show notes, but I strongly encourage you read up on this and you protect your eyesight. Everybody knows this by now, but you can literally burn a hole in your eye, in your retina, by looking at the sun. And the problem is that when it's in totality, it's safe, but that's only for a minute or two. Even a sliver of sun is bright enough to do that. So you don't want to damage your sight. So you got to be very careful about how you look at the sun. There's all sorts of clever techniques for this. NASA has a great page, eclipse2017.nasa.gov. And there's a whole safety section in there. And I do want you to read it, especially if you have kids, because kids will want to look at it. It's not that bright. I can look at it. And that you got to be careful. You don't want a problem. The cool thing, I remember this from the last time we had an eclipse, if you're in a shadowy area, you know, have leaves of trees that the dappled sunlight is coming through it, you'll see dappled eclipse on the ground as the eclipse comes through the gap in the leaves. It's like a camera obscura, and it actually will project an image of the eclipsing sun on the ground. And everybody in the United States should be able to see that. So find a nice grove of trees with dappled sunlight in it. Hope you've got a clear sky and watch the eclipse on the ground. That's the safest way to do it. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Jason in Lexington, Kentucky is next. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome.
Thank you all for taking my call. I've never called before, so, and thank you for recommending. I heard a couple shows ago, like you recommended the Mophie to somebody. Who
yeah, love the Mophie. About. Yeah, are you using it? Yeah.
Well, I bought one after that show, and I was on hold so long that
it saved you.
So my Mophie's coming in handy.
Right I'm so now, sorry. It's because I'm long-winded. I know, and I apologize. I know people are on hold for a very long time, but thank you for your patience.
I know. I think I drank four beers.
Oh, good. So you're nice and calm now, right?
Yeah. Well, I've been calm all day. I pretty much stay calm.
Good man. Good man. Yeah, the Mophie is a battery case for the iPhone. And I think they make them for the Samsung, some of the Samsung phones too.
I think they make them for different ones, but I mean, it's kind of awesome. I can't get my wife involved in it. I bought her one, but she lets the whole thing, her phone and the Mophie, go dead.
You know, it baffles me. I have the habit, as I imagine any responsible adult does, of plugging my phone in when I go to bed. In the morning, it's fully charged, and I get through the day.
That's what I do.
So many people, and I include my kids in this, it's invariably their phone is about to die. Whenever I'm talking to them, wait a minute, maybe they just want to get off the phone with me.
Well, I know hers is because I check it all the time, and it says 1%.
I've gone to dinner with my son. He says, "Hey, do you mind bringing a battery pack with you? Because my phone's about to die." So I know it is actually true. They just don't. Well, they don't have the habit of plugging it in.
She don't even use her battery pack.
Maybe she doesn't want to talk.
That's dead too. But that's why her phone's dead all the time. It's all she does is like stay on it.
I cannot live without a phone. My phone has to be fully charged. I have mine plugged in right now. If I sit down at my desk, I plug it in because I have to have my smartphone.
Gets down to 70%.
We are addicted to these, aren't we? We cannot live without a smartphone.
Mine don't run down that quick. I'm sure.
No, the iPhones have gotten pretty good. No, the iPhones. I would say one of the reasons I really like the iPhone. Still, because there's things I don't like about it, but one of the things Apple has done very well is battery life. And my iPhone 7 Plus, I get through the day no problem every single day. Just have to remember to charge it at night.
I get through all day with mom without using my Mophie.
Yeah. So the Mophie's for traveling and times when you're not going to be able to charge it. Stay up late.
It is. We do a lot of camping. And
exactly. Yeah.
We do things like outdoors and where we don't have plug-ins.
Well, what can I do for you today? Is there a question I can answer?
Yeah, I'm wondering about like mini smart projectors like that are Bluetooth compatible with your phone or with other devices you have. How well the quality of because I've seen some that says they're like 1080 and...
Yeah, the quality's pretty good on them. It's really the difference on these is brightness, lumens, they measure that.
Uh-huh.
And you're thinking for camping or something like that? You want to have a...
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily camping. I sit outside when I'm at home. I sit outside and I have a spot on my brick wall. And I don't have dark brick. It's painted light.
You want, if you can, a flat. If there's any protrusions or bumps, you know, that's...
It's flat.
Okay,
it's
flat. So a good white wall, if you really know you're going to be using it all the time, there's actually paint you can paint with that will... Because a movie projector actually is brighter than just a white wall. It projects, it reflects back. It has some crystals in it that reflect back. And then it really gives you a brighter image. And that's one way to handle kind of a lower... brightness projector is a good screen. You can also, for camping, you can bring portable screens around with you. They're not that big, and you can unfold them.
Well, I was thinking, would like just a poster board.
Yeah, again, it's flat white, which means it's fine. It works fine, but it's not. Mm-hmm. But if you go out and you buy the movie screen paint, it has little crystals in it that reflect some of the light back, and so you get a brighter image. There are this has become a very big category. Numerous pocket projectors, because not just for watch. And this is the issue: is most of these projectors are not for watching movies, but they're for business presentations. So you can put it in your briefcase. And you can even project from your phone. And so people who want to do presentations, maybe you're in sales and you want to do a sales presentation, this is a very easy way to carry it around. they call these pico projectors. So it's a whole category of little projectors. I suppose they're probably also nano and tiny, and but pico is the smallest one. LG makes a very good one that has a TV tuner built into it. So it's, you know, it's clearly for projecting video, and obviously you can tie it into your phone or your laptop and project video out of it. The LG Mini Beam, it's not cheap. It's about $550, and there are certainly cheaper choices out there. PC Magazine gave that their editor's choice, though. That's the one that they like the best, the LG Mini Beam. And it is teensy-weensy. Philips makes them. Magnasonic makes them. I think HP has some. You know, there's an interesting one that's an Android device with a projector built in, made by ZTE, which is the Chinese cell phone manufacturer. They call it the S Pro Smart Projector. You can buy it at AT&T, and it has it's got Android, not a very good Android, but that and Wi-Fi. So that's kind of an interesting choice too for getting the content out onto that screen. But I think based on the PC Magazine review, I would stick with the LG Mini Beam if you're going to spend that money. It's DLP. It's got a very good contrast ratio, 550 lumens. That's bright as can be, the brightest in the bunch. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We've been looking at eclipse2017.nasa.gov. There's a great map there that shows everywhere in the country where, you know, actually in the world, if you're going to see the eclipse, what percentage obscuration, they call it, how much of the sun will be obscured. Here in Northern California, we're going to get about 70% of the sun obscured, which is actually just a little sliver. In L.A., you're going to get about 61% of the sun obscured. It's August 21st. I'm sorry. Yeah, August 21st. And it is 10:15 a.m. in Los Angeles. So, or did I say that right? 10:21 a.m. In any event, no matter where you are, eclipse2017.nasa.gov is a great resource for that for the eclipse and for ways to protect your eyes if you're looking at it. Moving on, let's go to Brian in Poway, California. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Leo. Great to talk with you.
Thanks for hanging on.
I got a question on GPS navigation from Daniel Boone's perspective. has nothing to do with roads or traffic jams. It has to do with navigating between a beginning point and an end point as a crow flies on a specific heading on a compass bearing. Now, I only have a dumb phone, so I'm mocking up. Do I get an S8 Plus? Do I get an Apple phone? Do I get a dedicated GPS unit?
Well, so the advantage of an Apple phone or a Google phone would be that you would get, if you had data, you would get a map associated with the GPS. A lot of the GPS units, the handheld GPS units that Orienteers use and others, will just give you coordinates. They'll give you a heading, a bearing, things like that, but you might not get a map with it. That's the advantage of a smartphone because it's basically a computer.
I would be looking for downloadable topo map,
right.
And then also storage where I could, I found an interesting tree here, I found a nice rock here, and you know, X marks the spot and be able to navigate back to it.
Yeah.
At sometime in the future.
You know, I am not an expert. There's a GPS game that people play. Orienteering is using maps, right, of course.
Yeah, and compass.
And there are fun games people play. There's one called geocaching that is very popular where you hide stuff at a location. And then people try to find it. They know the coordinates. They try to find it. Then they take one thing and put another thing back in. It's a really fun game. And I'm wondering what people who do geocaching or orienteering use for GPSs. My sense is you could absolutely use a smartphone. There's no reason why a smartphone wouldn't be as accurate as a handheld standalone GPS device. And because it's a computer, it gives you lots of other benefits.
Now, I've heard that the dedicated GPS unit is going off of the satellite.
Exactly as the phone is. The phone is using the satellite too. It has it's exactly the same technology as a standard GPS radio in it. It triangulates the satellites. Yeah. You know, it's there are, I can't remember, 40-plus GPS satellites up there. You need at least three to know where you are. So it receives that signal. Phones have an additional, maybe this is what you're thinking of. Phones can also use the cell tower, but that's a very rough indication of where you are.
Okay, so what I was thinking is that the phone is doing cell phone cell tower triangulation versus the handheld GPS with the
Phone's doing both.
Is doing a sat link.
The phone's doing both.
Oh, okay.
The phone actually using three different technologies to locate you. It's using cell tower.
I've never seen. Okay.
Yeah, it's using cell tower. It's also using Wi-Fi signals because companies like Skyhook have for years been mapping. You don't need to get on this Wi-Fi signal. You just need to be able to see it and how strong it is, and you can triangulate with that. So if you're in an urban area, that's very effective. Obviously, in the woods, that's not going to work at all. And cell tower may not be very good. But you still have a GPS radio in most phones, and it still sees the satellites. Now, that's called – so the cell phone's using assisted GPS because it's using the satellites plus. Sounds like that's better than just a device that – only uses the satellites. As far as I know, they're the same technology. Now, somebody in the chat room saying that he's done geocaching with both a handheld and a phone, that the handheld is more accurate. That may be, although I would guess that a lot of people putting down the caches are using smartphone geolocation coordinates. So.
The display on a smartphone is going to be bigger, and I think...
Exactly. It's going to be more informational, or you could even... You know, there is one thing that you might want to think about. If you're looking at a tablet, the GPS radios in phones usually come with the data radio. They're part of a single chipset. So some tablets, iPads, for instance, that don't have LTE data will not have GPS. They will not be able to do this. So if you want to bring a tablet, make sure there's an LTE data radio in it. And all phones, of course, have LTE radios in them. So
LTA Lima LTE Lima Taco Alpha.
Lima Taco Echo. It's that's the name for the data portion that you get from the cell phone company. But that's only if you're going to use an iPad. In other words, iPads don't come with GPSs unless you get the one that has the LTE capability. Now, a topo map, you probably have to download in a separate app for a topo map. But that's, again, the advantage of a smartphone is it's a computer that can download stuff. You know, it's much more capable than a standalone GPS device. Now, as I said, I'm not a geocacher. I'm not an orienteer. I don't use these things in the woods. So I am anxious and willing to be corrected if there's somebody listening who does this, who says, no, oh, you got to tell Brian that if he's going to do this, he needs to get a Garmin 6864. It's the only way to do it. I don't know if that's the case or not. My experience...
Yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking about it for a long time. Can I tell you my perspective?
Yeah.
What it is we own a quarter of a quarter section. So it's like 40 acres.
Right.
It's rough, four-sided piece of raw land, two sides bound by road, and two sides are straight as the crow flies, but... You can't walk straight because you got boulders and trees and steer and javelina and deer and the occasional elk and mountain lion.
Sounds like a nice
on the other side.
Sounds like paradise. That's a nice 40 acres.
Yeah.
Did you get a mule with that? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Never mind. I'm just making stupid jokes.
Yeah, it is. It's in the middle of state trust land.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
Bounded by, and everything around there is like minimum 30 acre plus.
So
the wilderness,
and you want to use the
out there. Nobody wants to build it.
Yeah, because there's no roads. There's no infrastructure.
Well, it is a dirt road, but that's chancy. So.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I tried map and compass and just hitting a bearing at 273 across one side of the property. And
well, that's how real men do it, with a map and a compass. And which side of the tree the moss is growing on. But
I mean, I have my orienteering America.
Oh, good for you. That's awesome.
And then, so that works. But, you know, throw a pile of rocks every 50 feet.
So you don't have a smartphone currently.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I still have a dumb real phone.
Well, I think that that would certainly be a good use for a smartphone.
Now, the only caveat I have with this whole issue is that I think there is just a limited cell coverage there. Maybe one line of sight cell tower, and maybe one bleeds over a hill or something. I don't know how that exactly works. I thought it was line of sight.
Yeah.
But four miles line of sight out to the highway, there's a cell tower, and I can get it on the property where I want to walk.
So
it's only one tower.
That makes the phone a little yet less useful, but the good news is most mapping apps, you can download the map while you're in town and store it on the phone.
Yeah.
And the GPS will continue to work. It doesn't need a cell tower to work. You'll need the cell tower for data like maps, but if you preloaded them, you'll be good.
The thing to remember is LTE radio.
Now, I'm going to read you a section from geocaching.com. This is the game people play about geocaching using a mobile phone. Although geocaching has traditionally been played with a GPS device for outdoor use, an increasing number of mobile phone manufacturers are now supporting GPS chips. Many of them support geocaching via geocaching-enabled apps. So it sounds like they're not recommending against it. They're saying people do this. It's okay. So I would say, this is from the people who play this game. Now, that's a different thing than you want to do, but if they can navigate to a cache, I think you could navigate your property. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts. For this show, we talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next time.